This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. 4 years ago, Governor Rick Snyder signed legislation that repealed Michigan's law requiring motorcyclists to wear a helmet. Reporter Ted Roloffs wrote about what the changes meant in the state for Bridge. He'll join us later to discuss his article called Live Free and Die, Michigan's Motorcycle Helmet Law 4 years Later. But first, Kalamazoo Strong has come to mean a community remaining resilient in the face of tragedy. That originated with the February shooting in Kalamazoo that left 6 people dead and 2 others seriously injured. Kalamazoo Strong is also the name of a nonprofit organization that launched in response to those shootings. They're now turning their focus to another tragedy, the crash that killed 5 bicyclists and injured 4 others north of Kalamazoo last week. Rachel Kaiser is Business and Finance Director for Kalamazoo Strong. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Give us a little more background on Kalamazoo Strong.
Well, like you said, the launch of this organization came out of the February shootings, and it was kind of our response to how the community responded. People wanted to rally together. They wanted to do something. And so in response to that, we formed a nonprofit to give people a place to go to do something in crisis situations like this that don't really fall into an everyday tragedy that a lot of nonprofits deal with.
Were you then kind of, I guess, taken aback by the idea that you would have another situation which was a tragedy, people killed, people injured, on the scale of what we had with the bicycle incident?
Yes, I was extremely shocked, I think, along with the rest of the community, that we would have to mobilize a crisis response again, especially since we haven't fully healed from the February shooting. We've been hit hard in our community.
So specifically, what is Kalamazoo Strong doing in response to the bicyclist crash?
Well, we have set up a crisis fund, which we've been collecting donations online, and donations have come in from around the world. We've collected over $20,000 that will be dispersed to the victim's next of kin. We've also are in the process of finishing planning a memorial ride on June 26th with the Kalamazoo Bike Club. So their Cal Tour will be the memorial ride. That information is on their website. It's been on our Facebook. My part in that, because I'm not a cyclist, so I'm letting the professionals handle that part of it. And Toni Daniels is a board member of ours, and she's big in the cycling community as well. So she's kind of taking the lead on that. What my job is I'm rallying bicycle groups from across the world to ride with us on that same day. So we have bicycle groups in Ireland and Colorado, New Jersey, Texas, Ohio that have all agreed to do their own little group ride on that day in honor of our victims in Kalamazoo. And it'll be on social media as our platform for that. And it's really humbling to see the cycling community come together, not just in Michigan, not just in the United States, across the world.
So they're going to hold their own events in their own towns, their own nations, and raise money for these families affected in Kalamazoo?
Well, they're not necessarily fundraisers.
Okay.
It's just a ride in solidarity to show the way that the community comes together. And that's really where Kalamazoo Strong Organization comes in, is yes, bad things happen. Yes, there's, you know, certain ways that we need to deal with crisis and tragedies and, you know, the legal part of it. But on the other side of it, that I really want to push to get out there is the love and support that comes out of it, that we don't let the tragedies define us. The victims don't let it define them. We are defined by how our community reacts to it. And Kalamazoo has reacted with love and kindness and support to both of these tragedies. And we are also seeing that worldwide, that they're coming with us in love and support.
You mentioned money being donated to next of kin of the people who were killed. Could money also go to the families of those who were injured, who remain hospitalized?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yeah, all 9 victims. It'll be dispersed equally amongst all 9. I'm sorry. Yes.
So let's go back a little bit and talk about what you just mentioned there about the response in Kalamazoo. Is the sense you get running this group that people want to help when they hear about something as awful as either the February shooting or the crash in June involving the bicyclists?
Yes. In our community especially, people want to help. We were having donations and words of encouragement sent to us before victims' names were even released. The community didn't care who got hurt. They knew somebody in our community got hurt, and they wanted to help. It didn't matter. So that is extremely uplifting to me.
Are there plans for other events? Might you, you know, look down the road and see if there's other ways to help these families in particular?
Yeah, that'll kind of come as we work a little bit more closely with the families, like we did with the shooting victims in February with Tyler Smith's family. We're working on a scholarship with them. So that will be an ongoing thing. And something like that might come out of this tragedy as well, depending on what the victims and their families want.
But you might also assess that the families themselves need more right now at this time.
Yes. And I'm sure, especially with all of the medical care and other things, that things might come on down the road as well.
Do you also get the sense from people who donate that they're a little shell-shocked in Kalamazoo, that they have these two big events happen within just a few months of each other? And maybe that also leads to some of the rallying and some people feeling that they need to do something.
Yeah, I think that has a big part of it is helping and reaching out as one way for our community to feel connected to each other when we have been hit so hard. And like I said, we still haven't healed from the shootings, and to have to face something again is very difficult and hard. And I think we're all leaning on each other. And I think we do that by doing even just small events, big events, just writing. We've had cards, you know, sent in just with words of kindness. So people are just doing anything to feel connected to the community.
Now, you mentioned the Tyler Smith Scholarship. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So we are working with Mattawan Education Foundation and Tyler Smith's family. We put together a scholarship. We're working with them to get the parameters around the scholarship to make it really Tyler Smith. And he, you know, loved soccer. And so we're getting some of those aspects to it. But that'll be available to Mattawan students in honor of him. And that will be an ongoing thing, not just a 1 year.
And are there other ongoing efforts still related to the February shooting that your group is continuing to do?
Well, we have our Growlers game. We've partnered with the Growlers prior to this new tragedy to do a fundraising and a community event to honor those lost and those hurt. We are presenting Tiana with a check.
Tiana Carruthers. Who was wounded, the first person wounded in that series of shootings.
Yes, yeah. And honor some other people in our community. And we've now had to kind of put in, you know, an aspect of the newest tragedy to that, too. But that was originally planned for to be a February event fundraiser.
So is the Growlers game then going to raise money for both of these?
Yes. Things? Yep. So we will have a silent auction at the Growlers game. The proceeds from the silent auction specifically will go into the crisis fund for the cyclists.
And which date is that again?
That is June 24th.
What is the 2020 fund?
The 220 fund is...
Oh, 220.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. 220.
You're
right.
That's
220
okay.
fund, right.
That is a fund that is set up for the victims and their families of the February 20th shooting. It's an ongoing fund. As things come up down the road that they might need help with, they can reach out to us, and we have that money set aside to help them, again, with medical costs. We don't all know the full impact when something like that happens. And so we just are keeping money set aside for, you know, a year or two down the road, something might come up that, you know, we're not aware of. So we are keeping a fund up for that.
Okay. There's some other programs I saw listed on your website. Let me ask you about those. Crisis Closet.
Yes, our Crisis Closet is a closet full of clothing and shoes and some home goods, and it's set up to help people in the community that come across such things as apartment fires, where you have several families displaced, and home fires where you're losing everything. We also partnered with some of the school districts to work with them to get winter coats to students if need be, and that is, again, an ongoing program.
Is it donated items for the most part?
Yep, it's all donated items that have been donated to us from community members and outreach programs. We also couple with Open Doors. We've had a lot of professional attire donated, and so we work with Open Doors to get professional attire to their residents to help with their interviews and that kind of thing.
Job interviews. So someone would have a decent set of clothes to wear if they had a job interview.
Correct.
They can show up and look professional.
Correct. Yep.
Then there's Career Ready.
Career Ready is, again, that program with the Open Doors. So what we're working with on them is having our volunteers go in and help with mock interviews, resume building, the crisis closet portion of that with bringing in some business suits and professional attire to help the Open Door residents get gainful employment.
And Hero Talk.
Hero Talk is still in the works. That is a program for first responders. I think sometimes in these crisis situations, we focus a lot on the community and the victims and their families. There's another side to that, and it's these first responders that, you know, that show up and are in the trenches when these things happen. And so the Hero Talks is set up with a group of volunteer counselors to just give them a place to go and talk confidentially about, you know, things on the job that might, you know, hit them a little harder, such as these tragedies.
Yeah, things they've seen that the rest of us can only imagine and try not to think about.
Exactly,
too much.
Yeah.
Did anyone in particular say to you, hey, this is something that a first responder needs? Was it, I guess I'm just wondering, as you say it, it makes perfect sense, but I don't know that everyone thinks in their day-to-day life, hey, you know, first responders could really use a place to just sit and talk.
Yeah, we had it was a retired police officer from Kalamazoo that actually brought that to our attention, who now, he also volunteers with MCOPS. And
MCOPS?
It's another nonprofit with the Michigan Police Departments.
Okay.
And in conversations that he had with us, that came out that he said that's a real place that's lacking. And, you know, so if we could create a program, that would be great. So we're working on creating that and getting that off the ground. So
all of us are hoping, of course, that Kalamazoo does not have anything else like a mass shooting or a horrible accident that involves multiple people being killed. Let's hope that we've had our fill for quite a long time. And assuming that's the case, what are you hoping Kalamazoo Strong will be able to do going into the future, long term?
We'll continue to do our scholarships and our crisis closet. We'll continue to put up little programs and partner with other nonprofits to fill in their gaps where they're needed. Kalamazoo Strong Organization we don't need a big crisis to help. We're here to help with the small things too that happen. If a single individual gets into, you know, like a car accident and it leads to other issues down the road with, you know, job loss or something, we're here for that reason too. So it doesn't have to be big catastrophic events. We're here to help even, you know, with the day-to-day struggles.
Do the big catastrophic events, though, sort of mobilize us a little bit? And I guess I'm wondering, you know, can that lead to maybe solving some of those smaller problems as well?
Yeah, we hope so. But again, we are a small, small organization full of just volunteers. So we hope to be able to mobilize some further actions with this, maybe on a little bit bigger scale. But I'll need a little bit more help when that happens.
Rachel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having us.
Rachel Kaiser is Business and Finance Director of Kalamazoo Strong. More information about the nonprofit organization, including how you can make a donation, can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. 4 years ago, Governor Rick Snyder signed legislation that repealed Michigan's law requiring people who ride a motorcycle to wear a helmet. Bridge has taken a look at what that change means for safety and medical costs, and if the debate is likely to be revisited anytime soon. Ted Roloffs wrote the story called Live Free and Die, Michigan's Motorcycle Helmet Law 4 years Later. Ted Roloffs, thank you for being with us.
Good to be with you.
So that headline gives us an idea of what has happened over the last 4 years, live free and die. There has been an increase in deaths, and do people think that is related to the fact that people are choosing at times not to wear a helmet on a motorcycle?
Well, for sure the use of helmets plummeted after that law was passed. It was probably something like in the high 90s% people wearing helmets before, and now it seems to be around 30% not wearing helmets. So you've got a lot more people involved in crashes not wearing helmets. And it can be a little tricky looking at deaths by year, because one thing I discovered in looking into this, and I wasn't aware of this, but motorcycle registration has varied widely over the decades, as much as like 100 to 200%. So if you really want to get a handle on what effect it's having, you've got to look at deaths, and you've got to look at how many people are riding motorcycles every year. I did look at that, and I found, well, the number that died in 2015 on motorcycles was 138, and that was the highest in 30 years. And I also found that there was a correlation between the repeal of the helmet law and the percentage of people involved in accidents, in fatal accidents, going up. So you've got to kind of look at it pretty closely. But I went back to about 11 years before the helmet law took effect and looked at the number of fatalities, averaged it. That was about 112. And then I looked at the 4 years after the helmet law passed, and it was 126 dying a year. So, you know, that was an increase, significant increase there. And if you want to me, the most significant data that I found was a pretty detailed study that Butterworth Hospital in Grand Rapids did, looking at people transported to the hospital in motorcycle accidents. And there was a strong correlation there between not wearing helmets and having more expensive hospital costs. It was about $27,000 for people not wearing helmets versus $20,000 average cost for people wearing helmets. 3 times higher mortality rate of people brought to the hospital for people not wearing helmets. People not wearing helmets were on ventilators longer. They were in the ICU longer. And there's an injury scale that they had that they looked at, too, these kind of very sophisticated medical injury scales. And people not wearing helmets had a more severe injury scale for head injury. And there's this overall severity scale that they do. And again, people not wearing helmets scored higher on those. So that, to me, is probably as revealing as any of the data that I looked at.
And the healthcare professionals that you talked to pointed to data, but they also pointed to some sort of anecdotal evidence that indicated that people who were injured in a motorcycle crash without a helmet were just much more likely to suffer severe injuries or even die.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The co-author of this study, who's a trauma surgeon at Butterworth Hospital, he was on call, he said, the first few days after the repeal of the helmet law. And, you know, he said it was just evident to him as to what was coming into the hospital that this was having an effect. He said something like, wow, this is way more serious injuries than we normally see. And it was at that point he decided to undertake a pretty sophisticated study looking at people wearing helmets versus not wearing helmets and what they were seeing in the hospital.
The results in Michigan, would those be consistent with what other states have found when they have allowed people to go on a motorcycle without a helmet? In other words, can you duplicate this in other places across the nation?
Yeah, there's data, national data, to indicate this, and there's been other studies in other states, and you get the same general result. I mean, logic would tell you, why would it be different in any other state? You've got the same risks, the same essential medical system. You pile up enough numbers, repetition of enough numbers, generally statistics is going to tell you that if everything is equal, you're going to get similar results, whether it's in Michigan or in other states. A big part of this is how it ties into politics, and there was pressure for many years in Michigan, similar to how this happens in other states, to repeal that law. And I believe Governor Granholm vetoed that twice, and they took another crack at it when Governor Snyder's in office and passed it again. And I guess he didn't want to risk the political blowback, if he would have vetoed that. So that's how it got passed in Michigan. And it seems to, in a lot of ways, it ends up getting fused with this notion of freedom, personal freedom, and sometimes patriotism, people with cycles with the flags kind of waving behind the cycle, and their right to ride as they see fit, which they see as a, you know, almost like a human right. Don't tell me I have to wear a helmet.
In addition to the increase in deaths and the increase in injuries, can we also, and you mentioned costs just a little bit ago, can we also trace those costs in a way that shows that the rest of us, whether we ride a motorcycle or not, are paying greater insurance costs because there are people who are either, staying in the hospital longer, on a ventilator longer, et cetera?
It has. has to be, because ultimately, if you look at hospital costs, if an insurance company gets higher hospital costs as a result of something, in this case, it would be somebody not wearing a helmet, ultimately, they have to raise their rates to compensate for that. Or if it's the money's coming out of Medicare or Medicaid, ultimately, where does that money come from? It comes from taxpayers. So if you've got higher costs, higher medical costs, the bill eventually has to be paid, and it's not being accounted for by the motorcyclists who in Michigan are supposed to have $20,000 worth of insurance as part of this law. But you can even see with an average hospital cost of $27,000, that's not covering that, not to mention the much more serious injuries, or the more very serious head injuries, where you're going to get hospital costs that could easily get into the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So as you noted, the people who are proponents of being able to ride without a helmet will cite freedom as one of the main reasons, that the government does not have a place telling them that they cannot or that they have to ride with a helmet. Do they have an answer, though, for these costs? Do they think that it is okay for the rest of us to pick up the cost of people who are riding on motorcycles without a helmet? Is that a factor at all in their debate as they see it?
Well, the individual that I spoke to from this group that promotes the current helmet law, it's called Abate. That person actually, when I recited the numbers from the Butterworth Hospital study, he said, well, you know, we know that doctors, how they feel about motorcycles. They don't like motorcycles. They don't think they're safe. So you really can't trust that kind of thing. It's like, okay. But this study was published in a, you know, this is an academic study published in a medical journal that's peer-reviewed, pretty serious science there. So I guess one can make up their own mind as to whether that study is valid. But that group was dismissive of that study. And I've talked to them, individuals from that group before, and they're just generally, they don't believe in almost any evidence they see that would indicate that riding without a helmet is less safe. They don't buy it.
So there were some motorcycle riders who recently rode into Lansing with the message, as you say in your story, don't mess with Michigan's helmet law. Are there opponents of mandatory helmet laws who worry that Michigan is going to bring it back anytime soon?
Even the people that the groups that have been lobbying for return of the universal helmet law, they don't see anything on the horizon in the coming year or years that would turn this around. It's a non-starter. The chairman of the Transportation Committee, where there is a bill that's been proposed by a Democratic state senator, that chairman is Senator Tom Casperson. I got no return to my calls to his office, not interested in speaking to me at all about this. Basically, the Democratic senator who introduced this bill, it hasn't gotten a hearing, and it won't get a hearing. So you won't advance that. And I don't see this in all likelihood changing unless there's a change in the leadership of the House and Senate. It would have to flip over to the Democratic side. And even then, I think getting this current law repealed is a tough ask. It's like pushing the boulder up the mountain, I think, once it's been repealed.
Why do you think once it's been repealed, it isn't likely to be reinstated again? What makes it so tough to bring it back, especially in light of some of the statistics you've given us?
Yeah, there's a lot of inertia on the side of the way it is now. And that motorcycle group is a very powerful lobbying group. They're visible. They're vocal. There's a lot of grassroots support for that. So it's a risky proposition for politicians to come back and say, okay, we're gonna take all these people that believe it's their right as an American, a patriotic American, to either wear a helmet or not wear a helmet, and we're gonna force them to wear a helmet. That is a politically volatile issue, and politicians generally don't like to take on volatile issues. So it becomes easier to let this current situation be the way it is. And I just That's why you don't see a lot of states going back once they repeal universal helmet laws.
And you also did contact Governor Snyder's office about this. Governor Snyder signed the law 4 years ago, and it didn't seem, based on what his spokesman said, that it's likely to be something that is going to be at the top of his agenda anytime soon.
Yeah, you get the standard Snyder response on these kinds of things. He says he's always willing to take a look at fill in the box, X, Y, or Z. So he's always willing to take a look at this, but it's not a priority. And there's certainly any sort of inertia to repeal the current law is not going to come out of the governor's office.
So there are still groups out there that would like Michigan to go back to requiring people who ride a motorcycle to wear a helmet. Do they have any long-term strategy, or are they just going to basically keep advocating for as long as they can, realizing that they are facing, at best, an uphill fight right now?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I talked to a representative of AAA of Michigan, and they've been pretty vocal. They oppose the repeal of the universal helmet law, and they do favor reinstatement of that universal helmet law. But that person I talked to acknowledged that right now, the politics of this, there's nothing to indicate that there's a realistic chance to turn this around. I think the strategy over time is going to be just to accumulate more evidence, more hospital studies, more numbers, and just keep pounding away at it. You've got a lot of various health groups, emergency room physicians, hospital groups, insurance groups that all think that we'd be better off with the universal helmet law. And they'll continue to say that. But right now, the reality of politics is that the side that controls the legislature, it's a non-starter. So I think for the foreseeable future, it's the way it's going to be.
Is this also an issue, Ted, just based on what you just said there, that the passion is largely on one side of the debate? In other words, the people who don't want a mandatory helmet law just feel very strongly about that, and it's a big issue for them, whereas people on the other side may have studies and they may have evidence, but it is not the sort of thing that necessarily mobilizes grassroots support in the way that a debate has been able to do that.
Yeah, that might be fair, but I will say that the people, you know, you talk to people, and especially in the healthcare community, the people on the front lines that see what happens, who comes into the emergency room and what's happening, those people are passionate about this because they see it up close and they know what the impact can be for riding on a motorcycle without a helmet. Clearly, they care about this issue on almost a personal level. However, at the moment, that sort of interest and passion doesn't seem to be enough to counter where things stand with this, you know, people on the other side. And again, as I keep going back, there's not a whole lot in it for, or there's really almost nothing in it, if you're a Republican, to say, okay, let's take another look at this law, and let's just say, let's be hypothetical, let's say this bill the Democratic state senator has introduced somehow gets a hearing, passes the Transportation Committee, and now it's up for a vote in the state Senate. What is in it for a Republican state senator to go to this motorcycle group and others aligned with them and say, well, we're going to go back to the way it was. We're going to make you wear a helmet. Can you imagine what's going to descend on Lansing if that were the case? And see, that's why the politics of this are so difficult at the moment.
Ted Roloffs, as always, thank you for your time.
Glad to do it.
Ted Roloffs' story for Bridge, called Live Free and Die, Michigan's Motorcycle Helmet Law 4 years Later, can be found at bridgemi.com and also through a link at our website, wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.